Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hello and what is shaking, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. It is our November question and answer episode. You have questions, we've got answers, and if we don't, we're just going to make it up as best we can. Just kidding. We'll actually look it up if that's the case. Thank you so much for being with me today. Appreciate you tuning in. A few announcements before we get into the submissions for this month's Q&A session. First and foremost, thank you all for continuing to download, subscribe, rate, and review the show. For those of you that have not had a chance to rate or review it, please do so. A little star rating or a quick review goes a long way in kind of promoting the show, getting it out into the airwaves, and making sure that the algorithm kind of works for us so that other people can find it. Please continue to share it as well with all your wine-loving friends and family. For those of you that want to see more of what we're about, you can follow us on all of our social networks. We are most active on Instagram as well as YouTube, where you can find the video version of this podcast and see me dance around my office. On YouTube, we also have all kinds of tasting notes, wine-related updates, growing season, harvest stuff, all kinds of cool things for you to check out, and more content coming almost every week. So be sure to subscribe on YouTube in particular. You can also find us on the Book of Face and the social network formerly known as Twitter, but we're slightly less active on those, but give us a follow anyway. Number three, we are officially brought to you by a new little endeavor that we've cooked up over the last few months, Premier Crew Clothing. That's C-R-U, crew, as in clothing.com. You can head there right now. There's a little link in the description. You can use the code PREMIER for 20% off your first order. We got all kinds of great t-shirts, swag. There's going to be a lot of good stuff for gifting this holiday season, and there's going to be even more that we start releasing into the winter months in terms of like beanies, hats, sweatshirts, all kinds of good stuff. So Premier Crew Clothing, check the link out in the description of the video for more information and use the code PREMIER during checkout for your 20% off. Last and certainly not least. This is a little bit of shameless self-promotion once again. For those of you that have any holiday gifting needs and wine that needs to be shipped around the country, please make sure you let us know by the end of the second week of December. So by really December 14th or so, our shipper starts getting pretty bogged down with orders going and flying all over the place around the country. So be sure to let us know by December 13th what your wine needs are. Before that, if you need anything for Hanukkah, the new year, the sooner we get your wine order in, the better. Please be 21 years or older to purchase wine. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. We're going to be in trouble. Everyone's going to have a bad time. Be 21, please. Thank you. Bye. All right. Let's get into this, shall we? I think that was a nice kind of quick and dirty round of announcements. I try and get through that stuff as quickly as possible because I know why you're here. The Q&A episode is always one of my favorite ones to do each month. You guys always do a great job of submitting questions, and whether it's, you know, at tastings, out at the winery, emails or submissions through social media, it's all good stuff. So huge shout out to Mike, actually, out in North Carolina. Great seeing you during our events this month. And thank you so much for these first couple of questions that we're going to be diving into today. These are very interesting. They touch on quite a few things that we've kind of covered, but not necessarily in this much detail. We've got some great kind of other year-end and businessy stuff to get into as well. If you want to submit your own questions to be featured here on the Q&A, you can slide into our DMs on any of those social networks I mentioned, at MTGA Wines. You can also leave them in the comments. You can go to our website, mtgawines.com. Scroll down on that homepage a little bit. There's a little email form where you can submit questions as well. All right, kids, buckle in. Let's do this thing. Question number one. As usual, we're going to try and timestamp these so that I know where they're at, so I don't have to listen to the sound of my own voice as much when I'm editing this video. All right. On the most recent podcast, you mentioned being a consultant for other wineries. You seem passionate for the Missouri Couples wine and story, but did not mention their name. Do consultants who also make their own wine generally not say who they are working for because they are at risk of cannibalizing their own wine sales? Short answer, not really. Interestingly enough, going back to last week's episode, as I mentioned, these folks from Missouri that I've been working on their wines with them for the last couple of years. The reason I didn't mention their name is because it's not officially like public yet. They're still waiting on getting their website designed. The labels aren't even done yet. Even though we bottled up the first wine was ready to go. We bottled it. It's all set, tasting beautiful. But they're still working through some of kind of the trademark, legal approvals, making sure the website's up, making sure the design is good. So real honestly, I didn't want to put the cart before the horse in terms of promoting this wine, just in case they decide to change the name of it, or if it has to change for some reason, you know, outside of kind of the circumstances that we currently see in front of us. Very typically, though, I don't know any consultants personally that would be against promoting the fact that they're involved in certain wine programs. Interestingly enough, this probably isn't too surprising. I do know that some consultants will say like, hey, maybe I'm consulting for you, but only on a specific wine. Like you can't use my name to promote your other stuff. When I was working at Raymond Vineyards and for Boisse Family Estates, when they brought in Philippe Melka to help with some of their blends, it was very specifically for their Generations wine, which is their top end 100% cab that they had been making. And Philippe, you know, per his contract, or at least as far as I understood it at the time, you know, times have obviously changed. We're talking, you know, well over 10 years ago, that his name was not going to be associated with or used for marketing any of the other wines. For Generations and kind of that top end wine, absolutely go for it. But anything else, verboten. So that can make some sense, obviously, because if you're making, you know, and Raymond wasn't necessarily doing this, but let's say you're making a two-buck chuck, you know, esque wine, you know, Philippe probably doesn't want to be associated with that because he has a certain reputation of quality that two-buck chuck doesn't. Let's just put it bluntly, right? So, you know, contractually, there can be reasons why a consultant might not want their name associated with a particular wine and just focus on like the top tier of that particular, you know, production. More often than not, though, I find that if a consulting winemaker is on board, they're typically consulting on the entire program. So, you know, if it's a small producer, this is a little bit less of an issue, but if it's someone like a Raymond that's making a few hundred thousand cases of wine a year, you know, maybe he only wants to be associated or kind of known for those top end wines. So you kind of have to work within those confines from time to time. I don't think, though, it's so much because there's a risk of cannibalizing their own wine sales. It's more just maintaining their own reputation of quality, right? And kind of the wines that they are known for. You know, some people would be perfectly happy being known for two-buck chuck. Some people want nothing to do with that stuff. To each their own. So wherever you're kind of finding your lane as a winemaker, that's probably where you're going to want to promote yourself as a consultant and probably as just your own producer as well. So, you know, I think it's less of a risk in terms of cannibalization. In fact, very typically, at least from what I found, is that if a winemaker is known for working and kind of having their hands within certain programs, it acts as a great way for referrals and additional sales. That, hey, if people know that Thomas Rivers Brown has been involved with Mendingwall, there's a good chance they might like Outpost or Post Parade. You know, there are other brands out there that they have their hands in, And that could bode well for you, the consumer, because you know you like his style of wines potentially. You know that if you buy from these other producers, you're getting fruit from a different appellation, but it's going to be of a similar style. So the same, but different, in essence. I think the one big thing, you know, that we've talked about on this show is kind of that homogenization. So if you are consulting for a boatload of people, and Karen McNeil put this best in her social media post this spring after Premier Napa Valley and the Philippe Melka tasting in particular, not to pick on the guy too much, he's a nice dude, but this is a very valid question. And the example of him was very useful because Philippe has been consulting for, you know, CV Vineyards, which is down the road from where we make our wines. And I think the wines that he makes there, you know, are fairly modest in terms of their pricing, around like give or take $100 or so per bottle. He also consults for, or has consulted for, Donna Estate, which is like 500 something or more a bottle. So realistically, if you have the same winemaker working with the same grape variety, you know, not the same vineyard, obviously, but let's say Cabernet Sauvignon, right? And you have one of those Cabernet Cab Sauvs around $100 and another one around, you know, $500. What's the difference, right? Like what is that $400 difference actually? What are you actually paying for? So I think that's the question being posed by more and more people within the industry and even outside the industry, is that when you have just this handful of consultants making a lot of the wines out here and having a lot of influence on the style of wine that's being made, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think some of us, like myself, think that that's not necessarily the best for the industry, and that there's probably some sort of correction that needs to happen. Because whether it's Donna or anybody else, you know, if I'm paying $500 for a bottle of wine, it better be fucking delicious and it better be unique. It better stand out of the crowd and be like nothing else in Napa Valley. And it might be. I've had it a couple of times. From what I remember, it was very good. I've also had CV wines. Still unique, still very good. Do I have bottles of either of those in my wine fridge that's behind me right here? I don't, because they're not wines that, you know, I've purchased. I'm more likely to purchase the CV wines because they're closer to home. I enjoyed those wines a little bit better, personally. That's not a knock on Donna. That's just, I like that style of wine a little bit more. And, you know, Philippe's name, knowing that he had a hand on it, I'm like, okay, well, that's cool, because there's a sense of quality there that, hey, this guy who's very, very talented and a nice dude to boot, you know, if he had a hand on this wine, it's probably going to be pretty damn good. And if I can save $400 in the process, then that's not bad either. Keep in mind, we're not sponsored or brought to you by CV or anything. This is just personal experience. Like those guys, like they're nice enough. And the wines have been good, and it's just meant to be an example. So I think that's the bigger issue with consultants. There's not really this risk of cannibalizing. It's more of a risk of homogenization and dilution of your brand. I think that's really the big issue with consultants right now. We'll see how it shakes out. I'll be curious to see if this question kind of continues to present itself based on what Karen McNeil posted on her Instagram, you know, months ago. It'll be very, very interesting to see how that all goes down. Okay, question number two. All right. The current trend for wine in the $100 to $200 ranges tends to mention the vineyard the grapes are from, or at least the appellation. Is there a reason you would not, for example, say which vineyard the Merlot is from, or is the risk that you may not have access to those grapes down the road? You don't necessarily want to confuse your customers or change, or if the vineyard changes, imply that the wine is not as good as it has been in the past because of sourcing. So you're correct on the trend that very typically when wines get to kind of a certain price point, the more detail is readily available on the label. Although that's not necessarily the case, but very typically, you know, wines of a high quality want you, the consumer, to know, hey, this is who made it. This is where it's from. This is what it's made up of, right? There are a handful of different things. some folks will, you know, kind of hide that information. It's not meant to be deceiving in any way. It's just like, hey, this is kind of part of our IP, our intellectual property, and we're not going to risk kind of anyone else knowing how we go about our business. That could certainly be a part of it. I have had grape growers, actually, I've had two over the years tell me that because these grape growers are making their own wine, I'm not allowed, I have to sign an NDA, I've had to sign two of them, that I'm not allowed to let people know what vineyard I'm buying my grapes from because they don't want any brand confusion. So you could also have that. The latter part is very, very true as well, in that if a vineyard change does happen, you don't necessarily want to confuse your consumer base. So you might keep it relatively vague. Like even, and I'll use our Merlot actually, since you mentioned it, as a great example. So our Merlot, what we're known for, the white label with the M that has the kind of this blue color and twinge to it, says Napa Valley on the label. That's as specific as it gets. There's not a whole lot of other information readily available on that label, partially because of the label design. There's only a finite amount of space on these tall, skinny labels that we have. So real estate's at a premium. So we basically have kind of a quick little bit of copy, and then we have all the normal kind of government regulated stuff that has to be on there, which includes what it is, what vintage it is, who made it, where it was bottled, the government warning, so on. Now, the reason that we put Napa Valley on there is because of just that concern, is that, hey, if this vineyard source changes and it has said St. Helena for the last 15 years and it changes to Carneros, could that potentially have a negative effect on our sales? Personally, I don't think so, but that's not the concern. What I'm more concerned about is letting folks know that it's from Napa. That has forever been the reason why we've just labeled it Napa Valley. One, the vineyard could potentially change, but two, I just want people to know it's coming from Napa. That was what was important to me. Now, it's interesting that we're talking about this Merlot because in 2023, we had to change vineyard sites. And we changed to a vineyard that is not in Napa County. So we're going to bottle up that wine next August. Actually, it'll be the first time we've made Merlot from outside of Napa. And we're going to put that on the label. You're going to know exactly where it's coming from. This, in terms of the appellation, this is actually one of the growers that I had to sign an NDA with. But I can give you the locale. I just can't tell you who specifically we bought it from, although it's not that hard to figure out. So you'll know the appellation still. It's not going to have Napa Valley on the label, but you're going to know it's Merlot made by us from a different appellation, and then it'll have all the other additional information. The thing that we are changing with all of our label designs and kind of the in good faith and hopefully to be more transparent is that we are putting a QR code on the back of all of our labels so that, you know, because of the finite amount of space I mentioned, that you can link that QR code up to a web page, and that web page will have all of the nitty gritty details you could possibly want about our wines, from the types of yeast we use, the types of barrels, you know, where the grapes are coming from, who those growers are, if we can actually disclose that. And if not, hopefully we can at least paint a picture of the locale for you so you can look on a map and say, oh, those grapes came from there. That's the goal. You know, it can be confusing. And the last thing we want to do is confuse our customer base. Our hope as a small brand is that you've gotten to know us enough over the years that you trust us. And that, yes, maybe the vineyard source had to change, but it changed for a good reason. And we're okay with that. We hope that you're okay with that, and that we're still going to try and make the best damn wine that we possibly can. You know, our mentality is to be as transparent and forthcoming as we can, while also having labels, you know, on our bottles that market our brand in a good way. So there is kind of this, you know, line you have to walk to a certain extent. But after you get past that, you can kind of do whatever the hell you want, whether you're being as transparent as possible and sharing all this information we're talking about, or you're trying to kind of keep it as like a lie of omission. You're just not, it's like that little guy. Don't worry about that little guy. Ask no questions. You shall hear no lies. You know, my biggest red flag on any label is if I'm reading the back of label and it says it comes from some of the most premier vineyards in such and such region, I'm like, blow it out your ass, be more specific. And if I can't find that specificity on the label, it better be on the website. And if it's not on the website, you're full of shit. Like, sorry. You need to be more transparent in this day and age, and something we're actively trying to do, so that when a vineyard change happens, we, one, are praying that it doesn't confuse people because we've been transparent and they know us and they trust us. And two, because they know us and they trust us, we're not going to lose a whole bunch of business as a result, because we've built a great working relationship as a winemaker and wine buyer over the years, and we should be all good. So there are plenty of reasons, long story longer, as to why a winery or a vineyard might not disclose the exact source for their fruit and how they go about making that wine. There are plenty of reasons. You know, even some of the highest end wines in the world don't necessarily disclose a whole lot of information, which is crazy to me, but them is the ropes, right? So it just becomes a decision for you, the producer, and your marketing department, whether it's the, you know, one individual you happen to be looking at or listening to right now, or if you have a whole team that works for you, and figuring out what is going to be the best path forward to promote your wines while, you know, retaining your customer base and doing the best you can to grow that customer base at the same time. It is tough, you know, for someone like us. You know, the fact that we source our fruit is challenging. We've had to change vineyards multiple times over the years. Every time we've done so, it has been for the better. You know, it's not a decision that we take lightly. If it's something that we can prevent, we have prevented it. And when it comes time to change, because of any sort of extenuating circumstances, we do, because we would be doing a disservice to our clientele if we didn't. Plain and simple. That was one of the big reasons for why we changed our Merlot vineyard. Is one, we weren't going to be guaranteed access to that vineyard in the long term. Frankly, over the most recent vintages between 2021 and 2022, actually 22 in particular, we saw the farming and the quality take a huge nosedive. We had that contract come up, and they weren't going to let us renew it, and frankly, we didn't want to. It was a very easy decision, and we were able to found a fucking amazing Merlot vineyard that is way, way, way more akin to what we've wanted to be doing versus the 22 vintage, which I love. I think we did the best with it we possibly could. But, you know, the lack of oversight in farming from the grower was very clear, at least to us. The quality of the wine ended up being fine, but it was more than a little bit challenging. In fact, we're not going to be working with that grower at all, period, moving forward, because they have been a total pain in my ass, and the quality of the fruit it's not worth it. So anyway, that's my soapbox for the day. Long story short, hopefully you can find that information. If not, that winery is probably hiding something. If it's not readily available on the label, I'd say that's okay, as long as it's on the website. If it's not on the website, there's some pretty big questions that you and that winery, frankly, should be asking themselves. Okay, question number three. I saw this question come in, and I was like, I want you all to brace yourselves. This is going to be the fastest question I've ever answered, and I hope that you're ready for it, because if you blink, you're going to miss it. I'm telling you that much. Are you ready? Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Is the water flowing out of the light switch at the winery up to code? Yeah, absolutely. Don't worry about it. Moving right along to question number 4. Every time it rains, especially with these really heavy rains we've gotten, you never really know where the water's going to come from in those underground structures until you actually see it and you're like, oh, I actually have to turn the lights on. Well, hold on to your butts, as Samuel L. Jackson would say. All right. Question number 4. When a bunch of winemakers get together for a lunch, per your photo on Instagram, what do y'all talk about? What did we talk about that day? It is interesting. This is the kind of stuff that is pretty great about this industry that we're in, because the competition or the cannibalization of sales and kind of the edginess that could be here in this industry you know, it certainly could be a thing, right? But when you have, you know, a couple hundred of us all in a room together, it's pretty laid back. It's pretty easy going. You talk a lot of shit. You drink a lot of wine and you just hang out and be awesome. It's very, very simple. Honestly, the conversations, you know, are very brief when it comes to the vintage itself and actually even winemaking. This lunch in particular that was put on by the Napa Valley Vintners was more so of like the end of the harvest celebration. You know, it wasn't meant to be like this industry roundtable kind of thing. So we do plenty of those where we talk a lot of shop about winemaking techniques, you know, what barrel programs we're using, what kind of fermentation tanks, vessels or yeast or, you know, enzymes and all kinds of other geeky things that you could potentially do when you're making wine. There's plenty of that. When it comes down to hanging out casually like this, man, we just hang around and talk shit. Yeah, I honestly, you know, we really, it's not anything really of substance. Every once in a while, you have kind of a cool conversation with someone that you maybe haven't seen in a while, or maybe a peer or somebody that you look up to. But realistically, it's just to, we just want to kick back, relax, and be like, thank God harvest is over. Actually, for some people it is. Con Valley is still pressing right now, is out there today. They're still pressing. It's almost Thanksgiving, y'all, and there's still winemaking being done. It makes me so glad that I harvest as early as I do, because I've been done for like almost a month now. It's outstanding. It's very low key. It's very easy going. And I think that's really kind of the great thing about some of these get togethers that we have in the industry is that, yeah, we talk a little shop in terms of the techniques that we use and how we go about our business. In fact, we bring wines, like to an event like this, we bring wines to share and to talk about with people, especially if it's something that's like a little bit more like an R&D project or a new variety we haven't worked for. It's kind of cool to share it and show it to people for the first time. But outside of that, we're just sitting there making fun of each other, basically. At least that's what I do. I just kind of chat and hang out. Maybe there's somebody you meet and you try and get to know somebody. You can try and, you know, it can be kind of a networking event as well. But you know, you kind of find your little core group of people you want to hang out with and chat with, and you just go from there. So it's super, super easy going, luckily enough. All right. Question number 5. We've been rattling through these at a pretty good pace, actually. Question number 5. Ooh, let me write down the time here. All right. With the tougher year in terms of sales and a movement away from alcohol for younger generations, how are wineries adjusting? Are there still new opportunities to be found, or you just have to ride the wave of the bad year and hold on until things rebound? This is an interesting, I mean, man, if I had an answer for this, I'd be a gajillionaire. You know what I mean? This is the heavy hitting stuff that we're all here for. Had to have a drink of water before I get into this one. All right. So in theory, and I mean, this is how it should be for any business, that if you're having a particularly tough go, you probably should be doing some evaluation and kind of figuring out what's next. You better be having some conversations in terms of like a plan of attack and what you're going to do to move the needle moving forward. It's no secret that the wine industry and just the alcohol industry in general has been struggling over the last year. Tourism to Napa is down. It rebounded a little bit as we got into this fall season, but not nearly enough, at least for us in particular and many others that I talked to, not enough to make up for kind of the losses that we started with through, you know, the first three quarters of the year. You know, there's a lot to be... I mean, a lot to be desired right now. And I think, you know, you'd be really doing yourself a disservice as a business if you weren't taking a good hard look at your operations, your expenses, and trying to figure out like, hey, you know, if this continues, like if we had a pretty okay fall, but it was on the heels of a couple bad quarters, I mean, are we going to see that again into this new year? Is it going to be a really rough start to 2025? Or is it going to continue to rebound? And the reality is none of us have a crystal ball more powerful enough to figure that out. So we have to hold on to our butts. I guess I'll give you a little perspective on like what we're doing, because I think this is something that, you know, some wineries are, you know, contemplating as well. Many of you know that historically, at least if you've been MTGA Wine fans for a while and you've been listening to the show for the last couple of years, you know that we don't really distribute our wines. They're not typically available in wine shops. They're not typically available in restaurants. The reason for that is we have to discount our wines so significantly that, you know, it just doesn't make any financial sense for us because we're not selling enough volume, right? To give you some perspective, I think in the entirety of 2023, we probably sold about like $5,000, maybe $6,000 worth of wine to like retail shops or restaurants. The majority of that were actually was Blair Payton, Brittany's wines, because that's kind of what those have been built on. I can tell you our net revenue from that is very low. It's basically not a losing endeavor, but it's certainly not paying the bills, I'll put it that way. Now, because of the downturn in tourism that we were seeing, and we saw it kind of start to flatten out in 2023 for us, 23 was still a great year for us, luckily enough, but we did start to see it flatten out. So we came up with the idea of like, hey, let's try and reopen a couple of markets. Let's get our wines out into the public eye a little bit more and just try and distribute more of them. We found some great partners in Texas and a great partner in Missouri. So there's a whole two states that have some of our wines available. And keep in mind, not all of them. Like, you're never going to see the Cab Franc. You're never going to see the Single Barrel. None of the Grand Cask. There's going to be just a handful of wines that are readily available out there. And that's done very strategically as to not piss off people in our wine club, because that's one of the perks of being on our mailing list and in our club, is that you get access to things that the general population doesn't have access to. So we have to make sure to play by that rule for sure. But that was arguably a huge success for us because we pushed into those states, those two states, plus, you know, doing a little bit more work here locally within Napa and even actually up towards South Lake Tahoe and Reno, where Brittany's from. And, you know, we went from doing $5,000 or $6,000 in wholesale sales to close to like 33 or something. You know, it was a great success. We made some great inroads. We even exported some wine to Japan. That order just got picked up and shipped off last week. So within this downturn, that's how we adjusted. We said, hey, if less people are coming to Napa, if less people are doing wine tastings, if we're doing less events around the country, how can we get our wine in front of people? And for better or for worse, the distribution side of things is one of those avenues that we have not tried to capitalize on since before COVID. The last time we really hustled to try and sell our wines in retail shops and restaurants would have been 2016, 17, 18. You know, I still had a day job. I didn't have time necessarily to host tastings all the time. So we needed those outlets to sell our wine. And, you know, after 2019 into 2020, a lot of that just kind of fell off very naturally, which we weren't worried about because we had, you know, grown our wine club to a point, our mailing list to a point where the business was going to be very sustainable. And so we've continued with that. This last year has been the first really rough year we've had in quite some time, but that doesn't mean it's not without opportunity. So yes, there are still opportunities to be found. And if you're sitting there right now as a wine business, just riding the wave, hoping for the best, I don't know what to tell you. Because that's the stupidest thing you probably could do. You know, if you're specifically like only wine club, only direct, and you're sitting on a boatload of inventory right now, and you don't know how you're going to move it, that's a huge problem. If you're really focused on the wholesale side of things, and you've got a ton of inventory stacking up in the warehouse because it's not selling as quickly as it normally does this year, you got a problem. You know, it's you need to, and you have to be solution oriented. Right? Are you going to cut more deals and discount your wine? Are you going to run more specials? Are you going to open up a sales channel that potentially you haven't opened up before? Never in my life did I think I would be selling wine to Japan, but here we are. You know, it was nice that we shipped a whole 10 cases. They loved our Pinot Noir and some of our Diversum Cab. I was like, please, we would love for you to enjoy these wines. So we looked for new opportunities. was one of the big reasons we joined the Napa Valley Vintners in the first place. One, we are big enough. It seemed like a great opportunity for us for networking purposes and to potentially get introduced. In fact, the reason that we sold wine to Japan was because of a connection through the Vintners. So the reason we sold 10 cases of wine was because of this, you know, membership fee we're paying every month. you know, which in my mind is like, oh, I sold enough wine to pay for this membership for almost 4 years. So that's kind of nice. You know, it makes sense when all of a sudden it kind of comes together. It's like, oh yeah, we took on this extra expense, but we made up for it because we sold a bunch of wine. So we're trying to jump on new opportunities where they're available. You know, if those two weren't available, I can tell you right now, there are probably some of you listening to this podcast that I would have been bothering you over the phone and been like, hey, do you need any wine? Because we have bills to pay. Luckily, we haven't had to do that just yet. But, you know, you have to, again, you have to try and track down those opportunities where you can, when you can. And what is it? It's preparation plus preparedness equals success. You know, had we not joined the Vintners, we probably would not have been able to sell wine to Japan. Had we not had older vintages available, which they were interested in because we keep a library program, as I think every winery should, that's what they were interested in. And we sold a bunch of our older vintages to them, which is fantastic. You know, if had we not had, you know, kind of extra inventory laying around, we wouldn't have been able to open up Texas and sell wine there or in Missouri. But luckily we did. And the, you know, 30 grand in sales that we've seen is not a lot, but that pays some bills, right? The margins suck. We're not making nearly as much for every dollar that comes in because of how much we have to discount our wines for the wholesale side of things. But money in the bank in a tough year is money in the bank. So, you know, that's how we're adjusting. How other wineries are adjusting, I'm not really sure. Hopefully they're finding new opportunities like we have. Hopefully they're able to capitalize on them, some things, and continue to grow, or at least, you know, at least stop the bleeding, if nothing else, you know, because that's kind of where we're at. It's like, hey, you know, by the time harvest was rolling out, we were bleeding out. It was going to be a really, really, really tough fall. And in fact, it's still going to be a really, really tough winter. But the fact that we've made up some ground through some of these new sales channels means we should get through it. You know, next year is going to be really challenging, even more challenging, arguably, than this year. But I think these adjustments are what need to be done, because if you just ride the wave, I mean, you're just going to crash out, plain and simple. All right. That's all I got for today. I appreciate you guys. Mike, again, big shout out to you for the couple of questions at the top of the episode. Hopefully we covered everything and more that you wanted to know about the wine industry and kind of where it's at today. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Wind Up podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe to the show, follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines. That's Instagram, YouTube, the Book of Face, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Check out Premier Crew, crucrewclothing.com, and use that promo code Premier at checkout to get some sweet, fun, interesting, kitschy wine gifts for the holiday season. Links to all that stuff and all those good things can be found down in the description of the video. Have an excellent rest of your week. Happy Turkey Day in advance, and we will see you in December for a new episode of the Wind Up podcast. Cheers.